Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist and host of Roughly Speaking. This is episode 335 for Friday, December 15th, and the weekend. On the show today, we feature Baltimore bartender Brendan Dore and a guide to everything you need for the well-equipped home bar. Notice I said equipped, not stocked. We're not talking about drinks today. We're talking instead about the glassware and utensils you should have on hand when mixing, shaking, or stirring drinks for your guests this holiday season. We'll be visiting Brendan Dore at his place of business, the B&O American Brasserie in downtown Baltimore, and that'll be in the second half of today's show. Up front, how to roast the Christmas goose with Baltimore restaurateur and Chesapeake culinary expert John Shields, and with some help from Gordon Ramsay and Charles Dickens. So, if you've never read A Christmas Carol by Dickens, you've probably seen a movie based on the famous Christmas Eve ghost story. My current favorite is the Muppets musical version starring Kermit the Frog as Bob Cratchit and Michael Caine as Scrooge.
If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips would be cooked with his own turkey and buried with a stake of holly through his heart.
Now, did you hear that reference to turkey?
Cooked with his own turkey.
Excuse me, but I fully expected a Victorian reference to Christmas poultry to be goose.
Goose!
Not turkey. Christmas goose. Later in the story, after Scrooge wakes up on Christmas morning, grateful to be alive and transformed from miser to mensch, remember, he goes to a window, sees a boy below, and what does he ask him to do? He asks the kid to go buy a big fat goose for Bob Cratchit's family, right? Wrong. Here's George C. Scott as Scrooge in that Christmas morning scene.
Hello, my fine fellow.
Hello.
Do you know the poulterers in the next street but one, on the corner?
I should hope I did.
Intelligent boy, remarkable boy. Do you know if they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging there?
What, the one as big as me?
Delightful boy. Pleasure talking to you. The one as big as you.
It's hanging there now.
Well, go and buy it. Yes, go and buy it and bring them round so that I may tell them where to deliver it. Come back with the man, I'll give you a shilling. Come back in less than 5 minutes, I'll give you half a crown.
I could have swore he asked for a goose. I checked another movie version of the Dickens Christmas Carol and came up with turkey again.
Hello, my fine fellow. Do you know the poulterers on the corner?
I should hope I did.
What an intelligent boy. Do you know whether they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging there? Not the little prize turkey, the big one.
So it turns out Charles Dickens had a thing for turkey, and he, wittingly or not, promoted its consumption with his popular Christmas story. Now, according to an academic essay I found online, in Victorian London, Christmas Day was commonly celebrated by consuming not a grand turkey, but rather a humble goose. At that time, the turkey was an exotic bird too expensive for the common person to purchase. The act of Scrooge sending a gigantic prize turkey to the Cratchits represented a radical change in not only Scrooge's character, but also personified, quote, a radical socioeconomic transformation from a more Puritan capitalism focused on the accumulation of money to a more hedonistic consumerism focused on maximizing consumption. So in Dickens' time, the goose was the more modest of choices for the Christmas table. In fact, it's Bob Cratchit's choice. In this 1938 version of A Christmas Carol, old Bob comes home from the office with a surprise for his excited wife and very excited children.
Oh, Bob, you have got a load.
Haven't I, though, and all for tomorrow. Oh!
Did you get the oranges?
Yes.
And the lemons?
Yes.
And the potatoes?
Yes.
Oh, bless me. How did you carry it all?
Well, I really don't know.
Oh, what's this? Oh, what's this?
Yes.
Roast of beef.
No, try again.
Veal.
No. Tripe. No. Ribs.
Sausages.
No. Goose. Oh! Oh,
well, things are just the opposite here in the U.S. in the 21st century. Goose is more expensive than turkey and considered a very special treat. I've never cooked one but got curious about it in the last few weeks. With the help of our friend John Shields from Gertrude's Restaurant and the help of Gordon Ramsay, who recently opened a restaurant in the Horseshoe Live Casino in Baltimore, we'll get some advice on roasting the Christmas goose. We're back at Gertrude's. The linens are being folded. John Shields again, of course, the major domo here, walking around, supervising what goes on in the morning. What actually is going on at this hour? This is, we're recording this on a weekday at about 10:15 a.m. So what actually is going on now, John?
We are getting ready for everything. It's holiday time.
Oh, lots of parties?
Lots of parties. Every day, every night. And so we're...
Pardon the interruption.
Yes.
But there's a wonderful aroma.
It is.
In this
it?
Kitchen right yeah. now. Somebody's up to something, cooking something somewhere.
And it,
I don't know. Is that French fries? What's going on?
They're blanching French fries. Manas is over here working on his French fries, getting everything ready and getting all his, as they would say, the mise en place. Getting everything.
He's got a beautiful, that looks like Boston or bib lettuce.
It is bib lettuce. And we get that from Chesapeake Greenhouse. So that's a local little thing.
You know what I'm smelling right here?
Come
is
on over here.
Something
is
smells really good right here.
Well, we have a stock going on. It's a little chicken stock here that they're getting ready for some things. Then they have a little Creole sauce that they are heating up. And then just sauteing mirepoix.
Which is carrots, celery, and
onion. Carrots, onion, right? Celery, yep. And they'll saute that in a little butter. And they mix it in with rice and...
And that big pot with the whisk in it back here, what's going on in that?
I'm thinking could be cream of crab soup, or this could be the cheese sauce for the hominy for the weekend. Yep.
So all those aromas hit me when I walk in. Of course, you're used to that, right?
I am. I mean, that's kind of my potpourri.
it's a great potpourri.
It is.
I just saw some mussels. A container of mussels just came out of the fridge.
These are little beauties. These are from up Pencope, up north in Canada.
Listen, I wanted to take a minute to ask you about the Christmas goose.
Goose!
The holiday
goose!
Yeah.
And how to prepare it if someone were inclined to do that.
Christmas. Special time of the year. A bit like this bird. This is a goose. Don't be scared about cooking goose at Christmas because it really is a special treat. Everyone's worried about the fat content in there, but the secret is to get the fat out. And put flavor into it.
You know, every once in a while you say, okay, what are we going to have for Christmas dinner? And a lot of Americans, I think, go back to turkey. Some people do the turkey at Thanksgiving and Christmas.
I like serving the goose to the kids because it's seen as a bit of a treat. And it's such a nice alternative to turkey.
Or they have a roast of some kind on Christmas Day, or they have Chinese food.
Or ham.
Or a ham,
people,
right.
Or a ham.
Is that what you notice around the Chesapeake and Chesapeake cuisine?
Well, you know, I mean, you would find a lot of roast goose.
Goose!
In Annapolis and on the Eastern Shore because they had a lot of hunters. And, you know, you talk to any of the people in any of the small towns there, a lot of them will still have roast
goose
for their holidays.
I was going to say, there's probably two traditions here. One is the farmer who fattens the goose for the holiday.
Yeah.
They have that one goose that's on the farm all year. And
goose!
Make that goose nice and fat in the fall and roast it in for Christmas, right?
Exactly.
And then there's the hunter who comes up with the wild goose, the Canada goose.
Yeah, and two different animals, actually. And I generally go with the one that the farmer has raised, because why do we really roast a goose? Well, we really roast a goose. Well, the meat's delicious, but we roast it for the goose fat.
Right, half an hour before the goose comes out, bit of a chef's treat now because this is gold dust. We're now going to get the goose fat because we can use that for absolutely everything. The perfect roast potato or even caramelising parsnips and goose fat. Or sneak down at 5:30 in the morning and make yourself the most amazing fried egg sandwich cooked in goose fat. Hello, the perfect Christmas present.
We want that fat. You can use the fat for so many things. So you collect it and you toss potatoes in it and roast it with the goose fat. And that is actually even better than the goose itself.
All right, let me go over this with you.
Roast goose is a very fatty animal. So around the thigh section and the legs, you want to prick. You know, you take a sharp knife and prick all around there when you roast it.
We're going to score the goose. And start from the bottom of the breast and just go round. Now, don't go too deep. It's just the fat. Turn the bird around and start from the bottom again. So the whole goose has got these little diamonds all over it.
I generally roast it on a rack. so that the grease can come down. You don't really have to do the goose at a high temperature, 350, 375, for a couple of hours. And the goose is generally 8, 10 pounds, somewhere in the 10-pound range.
The secret about cooking a goose perfectly is making sure the legs and the breast are cooked evenly. The legs take longer to cook than the breasts. So open up the goose legs so it all cooks evenly.
Okay, so the fat that you're talking about is coming off the roasted goose.
It's dripping. Right,
you're not trimming fat off before you roast it.
No. You want to collect that fat. It's like gold.
This is gold dust.
There's nothing better.
And use it to flavor other things.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. I just want to go back to this question, John. Why do some people consider the goose a complicated roasting? Why is that? Because it is extra fatty? Because it just seems like people don't do it, one, because the goose in the store these days costs you more than a turkey or certainly a large chicken. But if you really wanted to do a goose...
Goose!
It seems like it's intimidating to people. Like it's somehow a lot more complicated than roasting a chicken or turkey.
And it's so not. I mean, and that's the thing. I think people around here in many places just aren't accustomed to goose. I think that's really the thing. It's a very simple. It's not any more difficult to prepare than a chicken. Salting and peppering inside the cavity, tying it up. You could put in either some stuffing in there. You could put a wild rice stuffing in there. You could put whatever you like. And then it's a roast for about, you know, two and a half hours. So there's really
nothing. It's based on the weight of the goose.
It is, and it's really nothing much to it.
Okay, I'm just wondering why it is we don't do it more often. I think because it's harder to get goose. It is more expensive.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have had their Uncle Joe shot a goose, a wild goose.
Goose!
Now, that's a whole different thing.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about that, because I have not had good experiences with wild goose.
Exactly, and I think that's why there's a bad taste in some people's mouths when they talk about goose, because the wild goose is not fatty. It can be very dry. It can be kind of gamey.
Gamey. The one word you never want to hear used to describe your cooking.
Some people will marinate it in like red wine for a couple of days before they do it because they don't really like the wild flavor of it. And it can be sometimes, depending on how it goes, it can be a little tough.
Save the neck for me, Clark.
Okay, Eddie.
So that's probably why people think, well, we should avoid goose because I had it was like shoe leather, Uncle Joe's goose that he shot in the Eastern Shore in October.
Exactly. But, you know, a lot of European Christmases and countries, they all have goose. And it's just they might have a turkey at one part of the holidays, but they will always have a goose around Christmas. You know, it's just that is their tradition.
And the most important thing when you come to carve the goose is to make sure you get rid of the awkward parts. Take off the wings and take off the legs. Make your life easier. Look how easy I've made my life already. Most important thing about carving is feel comfortable with what you're doing. So turn the bird around. Make it work around you. Don't work around the bird. Take the knife and just slice all the way down and lay them on top of the wings.
So once you've roasted the goose and you have all these drippings from it,
yeah,
and it's a slow process, you want 350, a slow roasting, it gets nice and brown. Does the skin get nice and crispy like it can on turkey or chicken?
It does because there is so much fat in it, and so it crisps up very, very nicely.
Okay. So that fat that's left over, what do you want to do with that?
Well, I take a little bit of it, you know, just to make a roux to make the gravy for the goose, because that gives a tremendous amount of flavor. But the rest of it, I mean, I might make some roasted turnips or make some roasted parsnips, and I'll toss them in a little, you know, cut them up first, and then toss them with some of that goose fat and some salt and pepper. That's all you need. And it transforms it into something that is beyond belief. I one time made a kind of a potato gratin, and I used the goose fat in between. Oh, my God. It makes you want to cry.
It's really so good. Better than butter?
Better than butter.
And that now is ready for the table. And you could quite honestly say, Merry Christmas to you all. You've now cooked your goose properly.
But as for the roast goose on Christmas, I think we should give that a try. Might have to buy a frozen one. I guess it's possible to get a fresh one around Baltimore.
Yeah, there's a number like Springfield Farms up in Baltimore County. Generally, you have to get in touch with them a few months ahead of time. You kind of have to reserve your goose if you want to get a fresh one. But
hey, one last thing about the goose that's given to you by a hunter. Is there any secret recipe for making that good?
Get the seasoning and just rub it all over the goose. But treat it as if you're giving your partner a real nice massage.
What I generally do, sometimes I will marinate it in some red wine with some garlic and onions and stuff. Then I dry it really well, and then I wrap it in bacon or put something over top of it to put more fat into it as it's roasting. And that seems to be the best way to go with that.
John, well, thank you very much. I think I'll let you know how things work out with the roast goose at Christmas this year.
Christmas, special time of the year.
Never done it. Going to give it a try. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Again, happy holidays and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you all.
Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and I can't wait to hear about the goose.
Goose!
You can find a link to a Gordon Ramsay video on spicing, massaging, roasting, and carving the Christmas goose in the notes with this podcast. John Shields is the owner of Gertrude's Restaurant in the Baltimore Museum of Art, where goose occasionally shows up on the menu. A short break, and then we go downtown to the B&O American Brasserie to find out from bartender Brendan Dorr what we need to fully equip our home bar.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
And on the latest episode of Female Trouble, Quinn Kelly speaks with Sarah Autry, who plays bass, sings, and writes songs in the Baltimore band Wingdam, a 90s-influenced guitar rock trio. Brendan Dorr, president of the Baltimore Bartenders Guild, joins us again, this time to go over a list of what makes a well-equipped home bar. What kind of glasses, what kind of tools and aromatics should you have on hand? I visited Brendan where he holds court, the bar at the B&O American Brasserie at the corner of Baltimore and Charles Streets. And I was there 10 days ago on an important date in cocktail history. So we're in the B&O American Brasserie bar, which is a beautiful bar with a beautiful chandelier over where the bartenders work and a big, big window overlooking Charles Street. And Brendan Dorr is here. So, Brendan, I'm finally in your workspace.
And you know what today is, right, Dan?
Today is December 5th, 2017. That's when we're recording this, but that's an important date.
It is a repeal day when Prohibition was repealed and drinking became legal again.
How uncanny that I happen to be here today.
Well, very nice timing.
It's holiday season, and maybe you're doing some entertaining, and sometimes you're good at that, sometimes you're not so good at it. Sometimes it's just beer and wine, but actually, if you want to put out some cocktails for folks, actually make some nice cocktails. Brendan's going to tell you what you need for the properly stocked home bar. And you don't mean just booze. You mean tools and glasses.
Absolutely. Yeah, as you said, it is holiday season. It's time to entertain. And it also gives a good opportunity that if you need to give a gift to somebody, some bar tools or spirits could make for a very nice gift to somebody who is an avid bartender at their house or looking to become a bar enthusiast at home.
Let's start with the glasses. So what kind of glasses should you have for a good variety of cocktails?
Exactly. So you just said it, a good variety. That is what you need, is a good variety. You should have a highball or a Collins glass, something tall and elegant. It doesn't
tall and cylindrical.
Tall, cylindrical. Oh, exactly.
I'm pointing to it. This is a podcast, sort of like radio. We have to tell people what we're doing. So I'm now pointing to a tall, cylindrical Tom Collins or highball glass.
Exactly. So a Tom Collins, a highball, you know, something tall, cylindrical, easy cocktail. Looks like you just put water in it, which we do sometimes. But Yes, a very simple glass. So next on your list should be a standard rocks glass. Something around 10 to 12 ounces will do. Some people like bigger rocks glasses.
Excuse me. I call that a tumbler. What are you calling it?
We call it a rocks glass. It also gets called a lowball, but also a tumbler. So it comes in multiple names. I feel like sometimes tumblers have a bit more of a convex kind of angle on it. So they open up a little bit, you know, on a slight angle. But, you know, anything that is a short, once again, cylindrical glass, you can do old fashioned Sazeracs. If you like your Manhattan on the rocks, if you like, you know, cocktails that are typically up on the rocks, or just you feel that's a little more sturdy glass for your hand, that's a really good all purpose, you know, working glass.
Is that a good Negroni glass?
That is a perfect Negroni glass, or Boulevardier for that fact.
Boulevardier. Okay, so, Brendan, what else do you have? Now, this looks like a cordial glass to me. That's something I might call a cordial glass. It's a, how do we describe that? It has a stem and
it looks like a short wine glass. That kind of has the top chopped off of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't curve back in. So this is actually called a Nick and Nora glass, made famous from the Thin Man movie series of Nick and Nora.
Say, how many drinks have you had?
This will make 6 martinis.
All right. Will you bring me 5 more martinis? Leo, line them right up here.
Yes, ma'am.
And so this is the glass that they like to drink out of. So the cocktail glass itself was popularized by the movie, much like the martini glass. Really, a cocktail glass was popularized by the cocktail, the martini.
What do you use that for?
So these glasses. So I also next to it have a coupe, which it traditionally was used for like champagne, but nowadays bartenders, we love them for cocktails, egg white cocktails. They look beautiful in, you know, just this is a little broader, a little more of like a saucer style glass. But either one of these could work great for your just single at home. You want to serve a cocktail up. You don't want it in the tumbler, the lowball, the rocks glass. You don't want it in a Collins. You're looking to present it a little more elegantly. Just a stemmed glass. The martini glass works great, but I prefer something that has a little bit of roundness to it. It also makes it, when you've had a few of these, it makes it a little less easy to slosh everywhere, where the martini glass loves to let you spill your tasty cocktail on your friend's shiny shoes.
Neither of those, Nick and Nora, nor the Coupe, look like you want to put ice in those. So you're right. Those are for straight-up cocktails. I could see a Manhattan in one of them.
Exactly. So,
and by the way, the egg white you mentioned, didn't you have a yellow snow drink? Is that yours?
Yes. That was mine a year or two ago.
Yeah,
it was meant as a joke I think it was 2 years ago when we got the real big snow. And I was being cheeky.
Okay, now this little guy here, this almost looks like a votive candle glass, but no. What is that?
So this is something if you're starting to, you want to increase your glassware at home. This is a whiskey glass called a Glencairn glass. So Glencairn is a Scotch whiskey.
Is he working on a case?
Yes.
What
yes.
case?
A case of Scotch.
And they developed a glass used, you know, with experts probably from like Riddell and from other whiskey experts to develop a glass that just puts the right amount of air and directs the aromatics the correct way. So it has kind of like a tulip shape, right? It's got that kind of flower. It comes out and then gets very...
Tulip shape is a better description than what I gave you.
Yeah.
It looks like it would direct the aromatics where they belong, right?
Exactly.
Up your nose.
Up your nose, exactly. Doesn't put too much air in, so you don't get a big waft of alcohol in your nose. Just puts those aromatics right where you want. So this is a nice glass to up your glass at-home glassware collection.
Okay, we've gone through all the glass, except here, this is a carafe or a mixer of some kind.
Exactly.
It's beautiful. It's a cut glass.
Exactly. So the two tools you need to make cocktails at home is going to be a mixing tin, which is a set of mixing tins. You have a large tin and a small tin.
Can we have some sound effects over there?
Sure. So these are they're nice and weighted, which makes it easier for when you shake. And they lock in real easy when you give them a little clap together.
That's a key thing. Lock in real easy. That means they unlock real easy. I've had a trouble with.
We don't know how to do it right.
Yeah.
The way to do it is get them to touch on one side and just give it a little tap, and they stay. And then move over to where they don't touch. Move around the rim about 90 degrees and just hit it with the base of your palm, and they come right apart. So don't.
Thank you for that tip.
Too hard. Yeah, that's your pro tip for the day.
That was my mistake. I felt like I had to clamp these things together real tightly so they wouldn't spritz all over the place.
Yeah.
And It took forever to get them apart.
Yeah. And a good thing, too, is so they don't come flying apart, is shake them with both hands together so you don't shake it. So if it does start to come apart a little bit, you feel it, and you can give it a little tap together again.
You don't want to do a one-hand shake.
Well, I don't recommend it for people who aren't very comfortable doing the one-handed shake. So back to the mixing glass, this kind of carafe that has a little spout on it. This is for your stirred cocktails. So if you're a Manhattan drinker, you're an old-fashioned drinker, a martini, anything that doesn't have citrus, juices, things like that, that is what this glass is for. You can use your standard pint glass, like what you'd see a draft of ale in, but this is a little nicer. It has that really pretty pour spout on it, so it makes it easy to pour it into your lovely Nicanora or coupe glass. It also has a little etching on it, makes it pretty. You can find it in different styles, different type of etching.
And sometimes at Goodwill.
Every once in a while, I do know people who have found some old mixing tools all over the place, myself included.
This little guy here is also from the stainless steel side of things.
So for all the people out there who don't like seeing bartenders work with these, this is a jigger. It just keeps our measurements accurate. Today, they're really nice. They come in, different shapes, different sizes. This is a 1 ounce and 2 ounce jigger. So one side is smaller. It does have etching inside of it to signify where a quarter ounce, a half an ounce, a three quarter ounce, and then the full ounce right to the rim. And if you turn it over, you have a 2 ounce side, and then the 2 ounce just has an ounce and a half measurement on it. So you have all your different measurement sizes right here in your fingertips. So next, some of the other tools. We have a mixing spoon. The mixing spoon is key for the mixing glass, so our spouted carafe.
Let me describe that. This is great. This mixing spoon was a spoon on one end, and this is made of steel, right? Twisted steel handle, and then you have a three-pronged fork at the other end.
Yeah, like a trident, right?
Yeah.
So the trident really is for...
So you know, when you stand there with your beard and the trident, you kind of give off Little Mermaid. What was the god?
Poseidon.
Poseidon.
Yeah, Poseidon. So the trident is for, say you're mixing a drink and you don't want to get your hands messy. You want to spear that strawberry and drop it in to be able to muddle or whatever. You know, you're trying to stay really clean. You can use that, the trident end for that. Or if you just want to be goofy at a dinner party and show up with your mixing spoon and eat your dinner with your steak.
It sounds good inside the mixer, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. When you move it around, yeah.
See, we need to keep the sound effects going. To remind folks, we are here actually at the B&O American Brasserie in Brendan's workspace. And this is a strainer spoon, right?
And we have two different types of strainer spoons. So we have this is called a Hawthorne strainer. This is the one that has the little wire spring on it, the worm, the coil, whatever you want to call it. This one locks down nice into the mixing tins. So when you lock that in there, it just stays right in place. It also, the little wire, when you have a real nice tight wire, it'll catch any little bits of debris you might not want in your cocktail if you don't want to have to strain it out a lot through like a double strainer, what would look like a fine little mesh strainer or like a tea strainer. Mm-hmm. This other spoon or strainer is called a julep spoon. Historically, this was actually for guests, and they made them in sterling silver. And because in the 1800s, guests' teeth were not always in proper dental care, they would give this to them because ice was a new invention in cocktails, and then give this to the guest to be able to hold back the ice while they enjoyed their drink. However, once again, they were sterling silver. Guests really liked to drop those in their pockets and take off with them. So very quickly, the bartenders wised up and said, we can't give guests these sterling silver pieces of tools. So they made it a little bit bigger. It was smaller. It was a smaller size than this.
So their teeth wouldn't...
Yeah, so teeth wouldn't touch ice. And so the ice wouldn't get in their mouth. It would keep the drink cold, but the ice wouldn't make their teeth uncomfortable. But bartenders then reinvented it, made it a little bit bigger, and now it fits in your mixing glass. So a lot of bartenders will traditionally use the mixing spoon. But if you don't want to get a mixing spoon, the Hawthorne generally fits just as nicely. There's a big debate whether or not to be traditional or just go with what works.
I'm going to get a photograph of all of these so folks can see them and we'll identify them in a caption along with it. Let's move on to some of the bottled things. Actually, what do we call these aromatics?
Yeah, the aromatics. Think of bitters, and we're not talking about Campari. We're not talking about the resurgence of Amari or an Amaro. We're talking about that bottle of Angostura that has the piece of paper that doesn't quite fit the label. That happened, actually, on a side note. That happened because you had somebody who made the bottle and you had somebody else who made the label, and they didn't fit, but they decided it was a good way to market their brand because people recognized the oversized label on the bottle.
No kidding. No, so and it now it just looks like a wrapping that's so familiar with Angostura. That's what you associate with Angostura.
Yeah, it stays that way. It still comes even to us like that, and we just crush the label down because we have to move quickly and a label sticking out kind of gets in your way. So the three bitters that I recommend for any home bartender to definitely have is one, Angostura. I mean, it is the godfather of bitters. It is one of the oldest bitters. It is probably the oldest bitters out there that has not ceased to exist. Even, you know, some have made a resurgence, but this one has stayed true. It has stayed in bars. It is a classic aromatic bitter that is in many cocktails.
You have two others you recommend.
Next down the line is Peychaud's. This one made a resurgence because people started learning about one of the oldest cocktails, the Sazerac. This is from New Orleans. It kind of has a cherry and anise kind of note to it, but you can't make a Sazerac without without Peychaud bitters. And then last, orange bitters. Orange bitters, you see them a lot in a lot of old-time cocktails, and just another bar essential. I mean, there are a plethora of wonderful bitters out there. There are shops dedicated to bitters where they have over 100 different offerings you can buy, but these are the three that I would recommend. I think Angostura, Peychaud's, and a type of orange bitters. I personally like Bitter Truth. There's Fee Brothers out there. I find Fee Brothers a bit sweet for my own personal taste because they use glycerin, not alcohol. So it does change it will change the flavor of your cocktail. It won't add that bitter. It'll definitely add orange, but not quite bitter. But Fee Brothers, I will give them credit. They were one of the first orange bitters out on the market when bitters really started making a resurgence.
Can you recommend two good books for the home mixologist? Or one good book. I mean, everything's online nowadays, but a good book for the home mixologist, one good reference book that you'd recommend?
You know, there are many, Dan. I mean, Gary Regan's The Joy of Mixology is a really great one. The Savoy is great. However, the Savoy shaking cocktails was in vogue, and so they even shook Manhattans in that book. So I don't quite recommend the Savoy for everything, but the Savoy is a very good standard cocktail book that was published in 1930, right before Prohibition ended. It was first published in the UK, then over here. But you know, Dale DeGroff, King of Cocktails. I just happen to have this one behind my bar. I don't have all my books behind the bar, but this one is a good one that I always recommend. It's called
The Craft of the Cocktail.
Craft of the Cocktail by Dale DeGroff. Dale is credited as one of the major reasons why we drink cocktails when he started the bar at the Rainbow Room in New York. Some of Dale's recipes, sometimes I find them a little sweet, but, you know, it's a really good place to start.
There's 500 in that book, it says on the cover. Exactly. And you've mentioned him before about the resurgence of cocktails.
Yeah, like I said, Dale is the king of cocktails. He is one of the major reasons why we are drinking great cocktails. So it would make sense to study his book. He did a great job. There's a lot of great information in there. There's some fun stories, but it's pretty simple. It's simple recipes, and I think anybody can follow it.
Brendan, thanks for this, and happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you too, Dan. I hope you'll get to enjoy some lovely libations over the holiday season.
You can see a photo of the array of glasses and utensils Brendan Dorr was speaking of in a Roughly Speaking blog post linked to the notes with this podcast. Check it out. It's pretty cool. And that's our show for now. I hope you enjoyed it. Comments are welcome. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance. The producers of Roughly Speaking are Steve Early and Queen Kelly. This is Dan Rodericks here at The Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
goose!